Welcome to this special program, Patterns of Care During the COVID-19 Pandemic. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, our faculty of Drs. Tiffany Traina, Stephen Liu, William Oh, and Tanya Spakai Saab delivered presentations focused on available and emerging research on the optimal management of patients with breast, lung, GU, and GI cancers during the COVID pandemic and presented relevant cases from their practices. I met with each of the faculty after their presentation to obtain more perspectives on how the pandemic has affected their clinical decision-making. We also discussed the results of a random survey of 75 general medical oncologists, which was conducted prior to this program, and of which the faculty also participated. The full program and results of the entire survey can be found on rtp.com/COVID-19/POC. To begin, Dr. Liu reviewed what is known about the management of patients with lung cancer amid the COVID pandemic.
It's clear that COVID-19 has really impacted every aspect of our life, and I think that's even more so for patients with lung cancer. So I want to talk a little bit about how COVID-19 has impacted our management for patients who present with lung cancer. Early on, while COVID-19 was really in its early stages, we had a particular concern for patients with cancer of the lungs. This is a disease that really has a tropism for deep respiratory tissue, and we wondered if patients who had cancer within the lungs or who had different treatments that impacted pulmonary reserve and lung capacity might be particularly sensitive to lung cancer. Some of the early data that had come out from the pandemic really was from China and from Italy. In an early retrospective review of over 1,500 patients with cancer treated at the Zhongnan Hospital in Wuhan, and they saw 12 cases of COVID-19 among cancer patients. Now, that infection rate of about 0.8% was quite a bit higher than the surrounding community, and most of those patients did have non-small cell lung cancer. What was interesting from that early data is that only a minority were actually receiving any therapy for their lung cancer. It told us that patients with lung cancer might potentially be at higher risk, but the minority were receiving systemic therapy. And this is limited by sample size, but was one of the early data sets that told us potentially one of the risks for patients with cancer are really the frequent hospital visits. Now, these data are a little difficult to generalize to the U.S., as much of lung cancer care in China occurs as an inpatient, but it was an early clue that perhaps one strategy to mitigate risk might be to keep patients away, to keep them outside of the hospital. We've learned a lot more over the next several months from global registries of cancer and COVID that have told us that COVID-19 is a particularly concerning condition in patients with lung cancer, as we see from some of these outcomes data. The TerraVolt study, which was led by Drs. Marina Garasino and Liora Horn, looked at an initial report about 200 patients with confirmed COVID-19 and lung cancer. 76% of those patients were hospitalized, a very high hospitalization rate, and the mortality rate of 33% seemed quite striking. These were early data from a smaller subset, but these were expanded at ASCO 2020 by Dr. Horn, and with 400 patients, that mortality number stood at about 35%. The CCC19 COVID registry, which included patients with all types of cancer, did have a subset of patients with lung cancer, and there the mortality comparable, about 26%, a bit higher than other cancers. Is there something about lung cancer that predisposes patients with COVID-19 to worse outcomes? These data are rapidly evolving. They're largely incomplete. We'll have a clearer picture as these numbers grow, but this high mortality we see in patients with lung cancer who have COVID-19, we're not clear as to what confers that risk. What aspects of lung cancer are responsible? Is it the disease characteristics? Is it limited to patients with a smoking history or emphysema? Or is it due to specific treatments? And by extension, can we modify our treatment, our approach, to help reduce that risk? We have general strategies to try to reduce the risk of patients from COVID-19 exposures. The first and perhaps most important is identification of patients with COVID-19 infections. It's a highly contagious virus, and testing strategies are paramount to controlling the outbreaks. Strategies that have been implemented at our center as well as others include pre-visit calls, checking patients for symptoms, temperature checks of every person that walks in the door, patient and faculty, and testing strategies to get rapid results. Some centers testing everyone receiving chemotherapy, everyone starting radiation therapy, certainly everyone with close contact or confirmed symptoms. Physical distancing has been an important strategy. This extends not just to the examination room, where we need to modify our general practice. in someone who's been receiving TKI for years, is it critical that I examine the oropharynx in the absence of symptoms, maybe increasing the risk of transmission? Is it critical that I be so close to the patient? Should I be at the other side of the examination room, our waiting room, our infusion center? The infrastructure and layout needs to be completely mitigated. This is challenging in some urban centers where space may be a consideration, and visitor policies have rapidly changed. Inpatients often precluded from visitors with fear of exposing patients and staff to people who may be asymptomatic carriers or exposing the visitors themselves. But I think this has particular significance in oncology. Lung cancer, all cancer, these are our scary diseases, and the caregiver plays such a central role to the management. For patients who may be somewhat fatigued or confused or forgetful as a result of the treatment or their disease, questions that are asked certainly concerns limited mobility. Not having a visitor with you at every step of the way has a significant impact on the quality of care for patients with cancer. We need to think of alternate strategies. Masking and eye protection have become very commonplace, required for patients, physicians, team members alike. But I think one of the bigger strategies and changes in general oncology practice has been decreasing visits, spacing out studies and visits, looking at what have been common practice. Are we doing that just for dogma? Is there any wiggle room? Is there any leeway in adjusting those strategies? And telemedicine has been a long overdue promise to our patients. By allowing patients to be managed remotely from their own home, we can decrease exposure and decrease risk to the patient, to their family, and to every member of our hospital team and their families. When we look at specific treatment strategies, can we alter the treatment of lung cancer to mitigate the risk of exposure? I think we start with the fact that it's important not to compromise care. We're balancing the uncertain risks of COVID-19 disease course for an exposure that hasn't happened yet with the clear and unforgiving established risks of an untreated or an undertreated lung cancer. And so we have to start with the absolute best care. But even without compromising care, there are different options. Is one option more favorable than the other? And I think strategies will vary significantly. We've seen COVID-19 prevalence and incidence vary significantly by geography and time. So we have to tailor these approaches based on the specific clinical circumstances in the specific geographic region. I think the situation in Manhattan in March 2020 is very different from August. And for Florida, March 2020, very different from August, perhaps in the opposite direction. So these strategies will vary based on the resources available and what the current climate looks like. But we need to understand a little bit about what those risks are. So if we look at specific subsets that we would manage within patients treating thoracic malignancies, driver negative non-small cell lung cancer makes up the majority of our patients with advanced lung cancer. Our first line treatment in the absence of COVID-19 involves immunotherapy. Sometimes we use immunotherapy alone, pembrolizumab monotherapy based on KEYNOTE-24 or 42, atezolizumab monotherapy based on EMPOWER 110 for PD-L1 high, nivolumab and ipilimumab recently approved for PD-L1 positive lung cancer, or combinations of chemotherapy with immunotherapy, carbopem-pembro, carbonab-pac or carbopac-pembro, carbonab-pac-atezo, or two cycles of chemotherapy with nivo-ipi, the most recently approved regimen for CheckMate 9LA. We can debate about which of these strategies is appropriate for specific circumstances, but how does COVID-19 influence our choices? Part of it depends on what impact systemic therapy has on COVID-19 infections. The risk of infection probably shouldn't be influenced by these treatment strategies, but the disease course certainly could be. Most of the robust data sets come from New York, which had very high, astounding incidence of COVID-19 infections. And among 423 patients treated at Memorial with positive symptomatic COVID-19, if we look just at lung cancer patients, treatment with immunotherapy did increase the risk of hospitalization and led to the risk of severe respiratory illnesses requiring ICU transfer or ventilator support. That same risk was not seen with chemotherapy, a bit counterintuitive. These are small numbers overall. And as I said, this was looking initially in all patients. If we look at a series from lung cancer specifically in patients with COVID-19 and lung cancer, the hospitalization rate, high, 69% in this series published by Dr. Lowe, mortality rate, 24%. These numbers are high, but consistent with what we saw in TerraVault, with what we saw in CCC19. Importantly, no difference in disease severity observed with use of PD-1 inhibitors. They also looked at timing, whether a PD-1 inhibitor was given at all or given in the past 6 weeks or past 6 months. Really saw no difference. There was initial concern because checkpoint inhibitors seemed to increase an immune response, And a lot of the poor outcomes we saw with COVID-19 infections seemed reminiscent of hemophagocytic syndrome, of cytokine release syndrome, of an overwhelming immune response that seemed to facilitate a poor clinical outcome. There were initial concerns that checkpoint inhibitors could add fuel to that fire. And fortunately, these data tell us that may not be the case. I think we can't deliver inferior therapy, but all else being equal, if we have alternate options that could provide comparable outcomes, I do think there's a potential advantage to immunotherapy alone. These data are rapidly evolving, and we'll continue to ask these questions. But by using immunotherapy alone, we could avoid myelosuppression from chemotherapy, preventing neutropenia and leukopenia or lymphopenia. In addition, we can employ extended dosing intervals, which to me is one of the more compelling reasons to pursue immunotherapy alone. In a nice review by Dr. Kartik Sehgal, we see evidence for extended doses of pembrolizumab, now approved at six-week intervals, atezolizumab and nivolumab approved at monthly intervals, and durvalumab approved at monthly intervals for small cell indication, but we can often get that approved for non-small cell as well. Using these extended dosing intervals decreases the number of visits and the number of infusions, I think decreasing exposure for everyone involved. We also strongly consider the duration of therapy. It is commonplace to use pembrolizumab for a period of 2 years in the metastatic setting. This number is somewhat arbitrary. We don't have clear data about optimal duration. We know from CheckMate 153 that indefinite therapy with nivolumab is superior in terms of PFS, at least, compared to 1 year fixed duration, that in the second line setting with nivolumab monotherapy. We use 2 years of pembrolizumab, but it's not clear whether indefinite therapy would be superior. I have many patients in my own practice who at 2 years had minimal toxicity and really opted to continue therapy. In the absence of strong data and no toxicity, I was very comfortable with that. It's always balancing risks and benefits. And I think now in the midst of the pandemic, COVID-19 exposure and possible infection adds an additional risk to consider. And many of my patients who have been treated for years, you know, during the COVID-19 pandemic opted to stop therapy, a decision I supported, and we now observe them closely radiographically. Duration of therapy needs to be considered and viewed a little differently in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic. How does COVID-19 impact our management of small cell lung cancer? Pre-COVID, our first-line therapy was really chemoimmunotherapy. Carboplatin, etoposide, and atezolizumab were superior to chemotherapy alone and emerged as a standard of care based on the IMpower 133. This is the first intervention in decades that has improved survival for this exceptionally lethal subtype of lung cancer. The Caspian study showing similar results a year later, platinum, etoposide, and durvalumab also improving outcomes compared to chemotherapy alone. How does COVID-19 impact that? Well, with the outcomes that we'd seen previously and unclear risk with immunotherapy, for me, post-COVID-19, my management is the same. Small cell lung cancer is an exceptionally unforgiving cancer. And for me, the risk of undertreating lung cancer is much greater. This is a disease where I want to afford my patient every opportunity to get that long-term benefit. I don't think that this is a disease that will accommodate delays or alternate strategies. So in the COVID-19 era, my strategy for extensive stage small cell lung cancer is really the same. I will say in the maintenance setting, I am employing the 4 weekly approved maintenance regimens of either atezolizumab or durvalumab to try to reduce risk. We try to minimize exposures as much as we can, but I am still using the same backbone therapy for small cell due to the aggressiveness of the disease. The theme here, can't compromise care. We still have to provide the best possible outcomes from a cancer standpoint while reducing the risk as much as we can. Driver-positive lung cancer is more of a question mark. For EGFR-positive lung cancer, we have several reasonable strategies. Our preferred option is osimertinib, a third-gen TKI, based on the FLAURA study showing superior outcomes compared to first-gen TKIs, both PFS and more recently survival. But we also have first-generation TKIs, erlotinib, gefitinib, second-generation TKIs, afatinib and decamitinib. The combination of erlotinib and ramucirumab, the VEGF receptor 2 antibody, showing superior outcomes to TKI alone in terms of PFS and also FDA approved. Gefitinib and chemotherapy showing a survival benefit over gefitinib alone in 2 phase 3 trials. We have several different options in the frontline setting. But how does COVID-19 impact our management of an EGFR positive lung cancer? What do we know about targeted therapy in COVID-19? In the series of over 100 patients with lung cancer, again, high hospitalization rates, high mortality, but the presence of a driver oncogene did not impact severity in either direction, ICU course or mortality. And use of a TKI within the past 1 week did not impact disease course in the hospital setting. I don't think these patients would behave generally different from the normal population without lung cancer. And so my management of EGFR positive lung cancer really reflects on minimizing risks and minimizing visits. While I think adding a VEGF inhibitor such as ramucirumab, adding chemotherapy to TKI are reasonable strategies with their own advantages and disadvantages, in the COVID-19 era, I really think TKI alone is a particularly better strategy. In this setting, with TKI alone, I can manage patients completely remotely. And someone receiving a TKI, doing well, tolerating treatment well, this is a patient who can be managed very well with telemedicine, using remote visits, remote laboratory. And I have patients who we haven't seen in person for many months doing very well. And I think very grateful and thankful to minimize their risks. And so for patients who have the option of oral therapy only, I really think that is of particular appeal during the pandemic. Adjuvant therapy is a moving target. We saw from Dr. Herbst at ASCO 2020 that the use of adjuvant osimertinib for resected stage 2-3 lung cancer significantly improved disease-free survival with an astounding hazard ratio of 0.17. While this is pending FDA approval, it's already changed my practice. Would I change adjuvant therapy for lung cancer? In this setting, I would not. I still think it's reasonable to offer the TKI in this setting based on the degree of benefit. But every strategy I can do to minimize risk, I think, is important. Telemedicine, remote labs, certainly in the resected setting, we can space our scans out more. So this doesn't impact my recommendations, but it does impact potentially the manner in which I execute them. I think one of the more challenging areas, though, is unresectable, locally advanced non-small cell lung cancer. For a stage 3 non-small cell lung cancer, our standard approach here is definitive therapy with concurrent chemoradiation using platinum-based chemotherapy and consolidation durvalumab based on the PACIFIC trial. But COVID-19 has impacted patients with stage 3 lung cancer in many ways. One thing I've seen too much of are delays. Delays in confirming that diagnosis. For someone with a suspected stage 3, we require bronchoscopy to invasively stage the mediastinum. This is really important to confirm the stage, as lymph nodes can be enlarged for other reasons, or non-enlarged lymph nodes may be involved microscopically. For optimal care, we need to know the mediastinal status, and that is typically done through bronchoscopy and endobronchial ultrasound. But this procedure is one of the more high-risk procedures in terms of transmitting COVID-19. Because this is an aerosol-generating procedure, it puts the entire staff really at risk. And so we saw a lot of delays in performing bronchoscopy due to the extra steps and precautions that needed to be done, the decrease in capacity. And in some areas of the country, a decrease in resources, in the availability of bronchoscopy suites, or decreased availability of pulmonologists, which may have been busy managing critical care units. Delays in bronchoscopy led to delays in the diagnosis, or at least confirmation of diagnosis, for patients with locally advanced lung cancer. There were also many delays in starting or receiving radiation therapy, in part due to unclear risks of radiation treatment. But if members of the radiation staff were ill, dosimetrists, physicists, radiation technologists, people that are unfortunately very difficult to replace, we saw delays in radiation being delivered. And there were many concerns from the healthcare provider side and from the patient side on the frequent visits. Unlike chemotherapy or immunotherapy, which may entail one visit every 3 or 4 weeks, here we're talking about Monday through Friday visits, trips back and forth, parking, waiting rooms, many exposures for a period sometime of 6-7 weeks. These long exposure risks were really concerning for patients and caregivers and led to delays in radiation, in part sometimes driven by the patients. If I was in a setting where I knew there were going to be delays with radiation, we'd have a few different options where we could manage care differently. One would be sequential chemoradiation, where we complete the chemotherapy first and add radiation later, buying several months of time. This is not preferred. We know that concurrent delivers better outcomes. And again, it's important not to compromise outcomes. And I think a preferred strategy would be using induction chemotherapy. Induction chemotherapy alone, full dose chemotherapy given at 3-week intervals, followed by definitive chemoradiation. If we recall, this was permitted in the PACIFIC trial and would still be considered a reasonable standard of care. And so if there were going to be delays in radiation, I may employ induction chemotherapy for 1 or 2 cycles and then proceed with chemoradiation afterwards, followed by durvalumab. And when we give durvalumab, here I would explore that 4-week dosing. Note that the FDA label for 4-week dosing is more for the small cell indication in Caspian. But this is, I think, a very compelling point to make with payers and pre-authorization to get that 4-week dosing approved. And I think that cutting the number of visits and infusions in half reduces the risk for this patient as well as the entire cancer population at the cancer center. We also have to consider toxicities such as pneumonitis a little differently. Pneumonitis can be seen with many lung cancer treatments. I think anyone who manages lung cancer has a special relationship with pneumonitis. Chemotherapy drugs can induce pneumonitis. Almost any oral kinase inhibitor can cause pneumonitis. Immunotherapy, one of the feared complications, is immune-mediated pneumonitis, sometimes a fatal side effect of immunotherapy. And radiation causing pneumonitis in a significant subset of patients receiving treatment. COVID-19 can have a very similar appearance. Ground glass opacities, sometimes geographically limited, but sometimes extensive. I think we're early on in understanding the radiographic appearance of COVID-19, and most of the data we have are for symptomatic patients diagnosed. Asymptomatic may look quite different, but when we see someone with hypoxia, shortness of breath, while we may think pneumonitis, we now have to consider the possibility of COVID-19. And vice versa, when patients present to the emergency room with a suspicion for COVID-19, we now have to consider the possibility of other toxicities as well. All oncologists are internists, and we learn that it's important to maintain a wide differential diagnosis. COVID-19 just has to be part of that. Here we see pictures from a few years ago showing diffuse ground glass opacities in multiple lobes, the top row before, the bottom row after. Here, diffuse extensive ground glass changes. The incoming diagnosis and suspicion here was immune-mediated pneumonitis. I would say in 2020, we would say this is very consistent with COVID-19. Turns out, in this publication from Dr. Barber, this is actually disseminated tuberculosis brought on by immunosuppression and immunotherapy. But again, just a testament that it's important to maintain a wide differential diagnosis in the COVID-19 era.